Chapter 36. Silent, but there had more than once occurred to her mind a doubt of its probability. Yet as he had only abandoned her opinion that John had schemed for Matilda to embrace the opposite error, that, finding he had wronged the young lady, he had pitied and grown to love her. And yet Jack, when he was a boy, was the simplest fellow alive, resumed Bob. By George, though, I should have been hot against him for such a trick, if in losing her, I hadn't found a better. But she'll never come down to him in the world. As he has high notions now. I am afraid he's doomed to sigh in vain. Though Bob regretted this possibility, the feeling was not reciprocated by Anne. It was true that she knew nothing of Matilda's temporary treachery, and that she disbelieved the story of her lack of virtue, but she did not like the woman. Perhaps it will not matter if he is doomed to sigh in vain, she said. But I owe him no ill will. I have profited by his doings, incomprehensible as they are. And she bent her fair eyes on Bob and smiled. Bob looked dubious. He thinks he has affronted me, now I have seen through him, and that I shall be against meeting him. But, of course, I am not so touchy. I can stand a practical joke, as can any man who has been afloat. I'll call and see him, and tell him so. Before he started, Bob bethered him of something which would still further prove to the misapprehending John that he was entirely forgiven. He went to his room, and took from his chest a packet containing a lock of Miss Johnson's hair, which as he had given him during their brief acquaintance, and which till now he had quite forgotten. When, at starting, he wished Anne goodbye, it was accompanied by such a beaming face, that she knew he was full of an idea, and asked what it might be that pleased him so. Why, this, he said, smacking his breast pocket. A lock of hair that Matilda gave me. And sank back with parted lips. I am going to give it to Jack. He'll jump for joy to get it. And it will show him how willing I am to give her up to him, fine piece as she is. Will you see her today, Bob? Anne asked with an uncertain smile. Oh no, unless it is by accident. On reaching the outskirts of the town he went straight to the barracks, and was lucky enough to find John in his room, at the left-hand corner of the quadrangle. John was glad to see him, but to Bob's surprise he showed no immediate contrition, and thus afforded no room for the brotherly speech of forgiveness which Bob had been going to deliver. As the trumpet major did not open the subject, Bob felt it desirable to begin himself. I have brought thee something that you will value, Jack, he said, as they sat at the window, overlooking the large square barrack yard. I have got no further use for it, and you should have had it before, if it had entered my head. Thank you, Bob. What is it? Said John, looking absently at an awkward squad of young men who were drilling in the enclosure. "'Tis a young woman's lock of hair. Said John, quite recovering from his abstraction, and slightly flushing. Could Bob and Anne have quarreled? Bob drew the paper from his pocket, and opened it. Black. Said John. Yes, black enough. Whose? Why, Matilda's. Matilda's. Whose did you think then? Instead of replying, the trumpet major's face became as red as sunset, and he turned to the window to hide his confusion. Bob was silent, and then he too, looked into the court. At length he arose, walked to his brother, and laid his hand upon his shoulder. Jack, he said, in an altered voice, you are a good fellow. Now I see it all. Oh no, that's nothing, said John hastily. You've been pretending that you care for this woman, that I mightn't blame myself for heaving you out from the other, which is what I've done without knowing it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, what does it matter? Apostrophe, apostrophe, but it does matter. I've been making you unhappy all these weeks and weeks through my thoughtlessness. They seem to think at home, you know, John, that you had grown not to care for her, or I wouldn't have done it for all the world. Apostrophe, apostrophe, you stick to her, Bob, and never mind me. She belongs to you. She loves you. I have no claim upon her, and she thinks nothing about me. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she likes you, John, thoroughly well, so does everybody, and if I hadn't come home, putting my foot in it, that coming home of mine has been a regular blight upon the family. I ought never to have stayed. The sea is my home, and why couldn't I bide there? Apostrophe, the trumpet major drew Bob's discourse off the subject as soon as he could, and Bob, after some unconsidered replies and remarks, seemed willing to avoid it for the present. He did not ask John to accompany him home, as he had intended, and on leaving the barracks turned southward and entered the town to wander about till he could decide what to do. It was the 3rd of September, but the king's watering place still retained its summer aspect. The royal bathing machine had been drawn out just as Bob reached Gloucester Buildings, and he waited a minute, in the lack of other distraction, to look on. Immediately that the king's machine had entered the water, a group of florid men with fiddles, violoncellos, a trombone, and a drum, came forward, packed themselves into another machine that was in waiting, and were drawn out into the waves in the king's rear. All that was to be heard for a few minutes were the slow pulsations of the sea, and then a deafening noise burst from the interior of the second machine with power enough to split the boards asunder. It was the condensed mass of musicians inside, striking up the strains of God Save the King, apostrophe, as His Majesty's head rose from the water. Bob took off his hat and waited till the end of the performance, which, intended as a pleasant surprise to George III, by the loyal burghers, was possibly in the watery circumstances tolerated, rather than desired by that dripping monarch. Vide Preface. Loveday then passed on to the harbor, where he remained a while, looking at the busy scene of loading and unloading craft and swabbing the decks of yachts, at the boats and barges rubbing against the quay wall, and at the houses of the merchants, some ancient structures of solid stone, others green-shuttered with heavy wooden bow windows which appeared as if about to drop into the harbor by their own weight. All these things he gazed upon, and thought of one thing, that he had caused great misery to his brother John. The town clock struck, and Bob retraced his steps till he again approached the Esplanade and Gloucester Lodge, where the morning sun blazed in upon the house fronts, and not a spot of shade seemed to be attainable. A huzzing attracted his attention, and he observed that a number of people had gathered before the king's residence, where a brown curricle had stopped, out of which stepped a hale man in the prime of life, wearing a blue uniform, gilt epaulettes, cocked hat, and sword, who crossed the pavement and went in. Bob went up and joined the group. "What's going on?" apostrophe he said. "Captain Hardy," apostrophe replied a bystander. "What of him?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "just gone in waiting to see the king." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "but the captain is in the West Indies?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, "no. The fleet has come home. They can't find the French anywhere." Apostrophe, "will they go and look for them again?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, asked Bob. "Oh yes. Nelson is determined to find them. As soon as he's refitted, he'll put to sea again. Ah, here's the king coming in." Apostrophe, Bob was so interested in what he had just heard that he scarcely noticed the arrival of the king and a body of attendant gentlemen. He went on thinking of his new knowledge. Captain Hardy was come. He was doubtless staying with his family at their small manor house at Possham, a few miles from Overcombe, where he usually spent the intervals between his different cruises. Loveday returned to the mill without further delay, and shortly explaining that John was very well, and would come soon, went on to talk of the arrival of Nelson's captain. And does he come at last? ? Said the miller, throwing his thoughts ears backward. Well can I mind when he first left home to go on board the Helena as midshipman. ? That's not much to remember. I can remember it too, said Mrs. Loveday. 'Tis more than 20 years ago anyhow. And more than that, I can mind when he was born. I was a lad, serving my apprenticeship at the time. He has been in this house often and often when I was young. When he came home after his first voyage he stayed about here a long time, and used to look in at the mill whenever he went past. Hat will you be next, sir? Said mother to him one day as he stood with his back to the doorpost. Lieutenant, Dom Loveday, says he. And what next? Says she. Commander. Andy next? Ext, post captain. Andy then? Hen it will be almost time to die. I'd warrant that he'd mind it to this very day, if he were to ask him. Bob heard all this with a manner of preoccupation, and soon retired to the mill. Thence he went to his room by the back passage, and taking his old seafaring garments from a dark closet in the wall conveyed them to the loft at the top of the mill, where he occupied the remaining spare moments of the day in brushing the mildew from their folds, and hanging each article by the window to get aired. In the evening he returned to the loft, and dressing himself in the old salt suit, went out of the house unobserved by anybody, and ascended the road towards Captain Hardy's native village and present temporary home. The shadeless downs were now brown with the droughts of the passing summer, and few living things met his view, the natural rotundity of the elevation being only occasionally disturbed by the presence of a barrow, a thorn bush, or a piece of dry wall which remained from some attempted enclosure. By the time that he reached the village it was dark, and the larger stars had begun to shine when he walked up to the door of the old-fashioned house which was the family residence of this branch of the South Wessex Hardys. Will the captain allow me to wait on him tonight? Inquired Loveday, explaining who and what he was. The servant went away for a few minutes, and then told Bob that he might see the captain in the morning. If that's the case, I'll come again, replied Bob, quite cheerful that failure was not absolute. He had left the door but a few steps when he was called back and asked if he had walked all the way from Overcombe Mill on purpose. Loveday replied modestly that he had done so. Then will you come in? He followed the speaker into a small study or office, and in a minute or two Captain Hardy entered. The captain at this time was a bachelor of 35, rather stout in build, with light eyes, bushy eyebrows, a square broad face, plenty of chin, and a mouth whose corners played between humor and grimness. He surveyed Loveday from top to toe. Robert Loveday, sir, son of the miller at Overcombe, said Bob, making a low bow. Ah, I remember your father, Loveday, the gallant seaman replied. Well, what do you want to say to me? Seeing that Bob found it rather difficult to begin, he leant leisurely against the mantelpiece, and went on, is your father well and hearty? I have not seen him for many, many years. Quite well, thank ye. You used to have a brother in the army, I think? What was his name, John? A very fine fellow, if I recollect. Yes, Cap'n, he's there still. And you are in the merchant service? Late first mate of the brig Pewit. How is it you're not on board a man of war? Sir, that's the thing I've come about, said Bob, recovering confidence. I should have been, but his womankind has hampered me. I've waited and waited on at home, because of a young woman lady, I might have said, therefore she sprung from a higher class of society than one. Her father was a landscape painter, maybe you've heard of him, sir. The name is Garland. Apostrophe, he painted that view of our village here, apostrophe, said Captain Hardy, looking towards a dark little picture in the corner of the room. Bob looked, and went on, as if to the picture, well, sir, I have found that however, the press gang came a week or two ago, and didn't get hold of me. I didn't care to go aboard as a press man. ... There has been a severe impressment. It is of course a disagreeable necessity, but it can't be helped. ... Since then, sir, something has happened that makes me wish they had found me, and I have come tonight to ask if I could enter on board your ship the Victory. ... The captain shook his head severely, and presently observed. I am glad to find that you think of entering the service, Loveday. Smart men are badly wanted. But it will not be in your power to choose your ship. ... Well, sir, then I must take my chance elsewhere, said Bob, his face indicating the disappointment he would not fully express. 'Twas only that I felt I would much rather serve under you than anybody else, my father and all of us being known to ye, Captain Hardy, and our families belonging to the same parts. ... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.